Hello, I'm Eric Sue.
And I'm Louis Everest.
And you're listening to another episode of Lou and the Sue, a podcast about sociology, brought to you by UniSA, the university that really likes to send people emails.
Oh, God. It's not so much the initial emails, it's the bad reply all etiquette. That's the thing that gets me. When I see an email saying, congratulations, so-and-so is retired, or so-and-so
is promoted, I like it.
Oh, God, here we go. The next hour is going to be so many replies, congratulations.
Yeah.
Oh.
Yeah.
Honestly, that should be a sackable offense.
In today's episode, we're going to look at the work of Michel Foucault, one of France's most famous, or maybe infamous, 20th century social theorist and social researchers. We're going to specifically look at his work, Discipline and Punishment. And we're going to try to give you a broad overview of what he's trying to accomplish in this particular text. And note to listeners, we have done another episode on his theory of power, which we'd highly recommend that you listen to first before this, but you don't need to. You don't need to. With this particular text, Foucault is doing a lot of interesting things. He is not only trying to further his innovative, if not slightly unconventional, understanding of power, which focuses on how it can be something that comes from the bottom up rather than top down. But he's also trying to make an anthropological argument of how power works really in the contemporary modern world. He's trying to talk about how there's been social developments that have caused power to be expressed in slightly different ways than it used to in the past. And so this leads him to talk about the rise of what he calls the disciplinary society. And to get at what he means here, he focuses on the prison. He focuses on this idea of the panopticon. And he describes what a panopticon refers to. What is a panopticon? And why is it relevant, Louis, to any really understanding anything about how things work in contemporary modern societies?
I love the definition of the panopticon. And so Foucault is really going back to the work of Jeremy Bentham here, famous utilitarian and liberal thinker. And Jeremy Bentham's design of the panopticon. And to describe some of the features of this, it's a prison design, an architectural prison design.
Yeah.
And it involves a circular building with the prisoners being in cells around the perimeter of the circle, and with there being a central tower in which a guard can sit in the central tower and can see out and view all of the prisoners from their central tower. And there are some really other interesting and important features. So, for instance, the guard has a glass lantern and has certain shades or shutters on their internal position and other mechanisms so that the guard can always see the prisoners or potentially see the prisoners, but the prisoners can never see the guard. And that's such a key part of the panopticon. So the prisoners never really know when they're being watched, when the guard's viewing their behavior. And but the guard doesn't always have to be, but could be viewing their behavior at any point in time.
This is, by the way, a marked change in how prisons are normally or have previously been constructed. Like when I think of a prison, especially before the 17th and 18th century, I think of dungeons.
Yeah.
I think of people being locked away in like the basement or maybe in a high tower, but removed from view. Prisoners shrouded in darkness.
That's right.
But in the panopticon, what you see is prisoners are always lit up. They're always visible. And it's the guard that's shrouded in darkness.
That's right. Yeah. Right? So I mean, there are some key mechanisms, key differences between those two models. Yeah. Number one, you go from locking a bunch of prisoners in a single cell, just getting them all kind of stuck away somewhere where you don't need to look at them, to having individual cells for individual prisoners. That's a key part of it. And like you said, you go from hiding these people who have breached society's rules and need to be kind of locked away and thrown the key, to bring them into the light. You're kind of exercising a form of power based around leaving them visible at all times.
Yeah. And think about what that would do then. Like, let's imagine that I, you know, commit a crime in like the 19th century, and I get sent to a prison based on the Panopticon. So I'm in my little cell, right? And it's always lit, and I can't see what the guard sees.
Yeah.
I'm just going to presume that the guard could be looking at me. So I have to start regulating my behavior.
Well, you know what I think personally when I think about this?
Go on.
I've had both officers that haven't had windows.
Yeah.
Particularly the internal hallways.
Yeah.
And officers that do have windows.
Yeah.
And when I've been in an office that doesn't have windows to internal hallways, I'm much more likely to watch a cheeky YouTube clip during the day. Maybe my lunch break will stay an extra 15 minutes longer. But when there are windows, even if there's not someone actually looking in, the chance of someone walking down the hallway.
Yeah. If you're playing like solitaire or something they'll see it.
Yeah, that's right.
But you don't know. So you're actually hinting at then a point that Foucault is making, that the dynamics of the panopticon, right, of panopticism, have basically exceeded the boundaries of the prison.
That's right. This isn't an article based around the best prison design. I mean, it'd be great if it was.
That's right.
But it's not. He's talking about those mechanisms that the panopticon thrives on, leaving people visible, giving them the potential of being viewed at any moment. He's saying that those processes, those principles are now being incorporated into lots of different aspects of society as a new means of power, of controlling populations, but one that's not based on just putting them in a dungeon and punishing them.
And you can see how he's trying to articulate a very unique understanding of power here. This is an understanding of power that works through us as individuals, but it works through us in a very subtle way because it's something we internalize. If you're trying to get people to behave in a certain way, it doesn't make much sense to constantly have to like force them to do something.
Yeah, absolutely.
If you can convince someone that it's in their best interest, and they actually think it's not that it's when they even don't even think they're being convinced.
Yeah,
that they themselves have come to this decision or this view. That's when power is really effective, according to Foucault.
Yeah.
And he thinks that this technique, this form of power is so powerful that it really is a key feature of how modern societies work.
Yeah.
And can you think of any other examples besides an open plan office, Louis, of panopticism?
Yeah, well, I suppose in normal, you know, urban settings now, CCTV cameras that are around in lots of different locations. And once again, it's not that you're always being filmed. It's the sense that you always could be being filmed, that there could always be someone watching you that's supposed to promote good behavior. But I think the point you made as well is really key, is that when this power reaches its most effective point is when you're the one doing the monitoring. You're monitoring your own behavior. And if power's been really, truly effective, then you don't really need anyone viewing at any point in time because you'll just start to feel weird when you misbehave because it's so internalized. Yeah. You're your own guard at that stage.
Think about, I'm not sure if you've ever eaten at IKEA before or as the other, you know, as the Nordic countries pronounce it, is things IKEA. Yeah.
It's where I take all my first dates.
Sarah's a very lucky woman.
Yeah, when I started doing vegan meatballs.
And so, you know, if you've eaten at IKEA, what's interesting about that experience is you see loads of people willingly taking their trays back to where they belong, you know, to be cleaned. You could just leave them there, but see, people have internalized the right thing to do.
Yeah.
Which is going to be much more profitable for IKEA.
Yeah.
Is to bring your plate back.
Exactly.
Is to bring your tray back.
Exactly.
Now, the thing about this work is Foucault's not just trying to say that this has occurred and that's it. He's trying to also link it up to other historical and social developments. And I think this discussion is really interesting. And actually, this maybe leads us to the segment we like to call Say What? Where we look at a quote that's in need of further explanation. So the quote that I have in front of me is as follows. Foucault writes, "The development of the disciplines marks the appearance of elementary techniques belonging to a quite different economy. Mechanisms of power, which instead of proceeding by deduction, are integrated into the productive efficiencies of the apparatuses from within, into the growth of this efficiency and into the use of what it produces." It's quite a mouthful, but I think this quote is actually a pretty good one. Because for my reading, Foucault is trying to say there's reasons why these disciplinary techniques of power came to be.
Absolutely.
Because they aligned with mainly capitalism and industrialization.
Yeah.
Really, the rise of the modern world saw the use of discipline being used a lot more.
Exactly. Well,
more extensively.
Yeah. I mean, he outlines sort of economic, political, and scientific historical trends, certain aspects of the world that were occurring during the development of this disciplinary form of power. And he says there are all these sort of key historical reasons that disciplinary power became the dominant form of power. And the first one that you've already touched upon is exactly that. The development of capitalism as a means of production and exchange. Because if you think about what capitalism needs, it doesn't need a mass cohort of people who can all do the same thing. Because all of a sudden, production in society is becoming highly specialized. There's a division of labor. You need people who can do all sorts of different things. And so what this form of power, what disciplinary power is really good at, is individualizing people and promoting individuals to do certain things, to go to universities and get different types of degrees, to get different skills, and for people to want to do it. It's a really efficient thing, right?
It makes sense, isn't it? Like, let's imagine you're trying to survey what's going on in society. The emergence of capitalism and as modernity becomes more advanced, you start seeing loads more people.
Congregate
in urban spaces.
Yeah.
You see industrialization happening. You see huge factories start going up. And then you think, we want a capitalist system to run. Yeah. How are we going to do it? And it's not by just forcing people using repressive power.
No.
Because repressive power is so inefficient.
It would cost a lot of money, wouldn't it?
Cost a lot of money. That makes sense. If you have to force someone to do something at the threat of violence, that's exhausting. I'm not to say that I've done it. You know what I mean? I don't want to give off the impression that I'm just going around people students. Like, do it, do it. You know?
That's right.
Yeah. But it makes sense then that you'd want people to internalize the very values, the very practices that serve this overall system.
Yeah.
Serve this overall power dynamic.
And there's also a risk involved in punishment-based approaches to managing populations, particularly with capitalism. We think back to Marx and Marx's argument about how capitalism creates a bourgeoisie and a proletariat. Well, you don't want to just punish society because that just creates a mass, a homogenous group that could revolt. One of the really amazing things for Foucault about this disciplinary form of power is that people in their individual cells, they're inside their own heads, they're being encouraged to act in what they perceive as individual ways. They don't have shared common identities with their fellow inmates. And so it doesn't risk creating this proletariat, this mass that could overthrow the, you know, the powerful people in society.
The other thing about the development of capitalism, which I think is quite interesting, is how specialized tasks and jobs become.
Yeah.
And so if you think about how complicated it is to manage a modern organization or a modern corporation, you need to rely on people wanting to do the right thing.
Yeah.
And if the right thing especially serves a system at large.
Exactly. It's sort of like, you know, having 10 people in a room and giving each one of them a manual to a kind of a certain job that needs doing and then offering to pay them money to read the manual and do the job, as opposed to having a person in that room who punishes people if they don't do a job correctly and having to keep that person in that room forever, having that system. You can't punish that entire population to all take on specific roles.
Yeah. And also, I should quickly mention, the other point that Foucault makes is that disciplinary power is power at reaching its maximum intensity. If it's done in a certain way, It's 24/7.
Yeah.
With repressive power, once the guard is no longer looking at you, you know they're not looking at you, you can go back and play your solitaire and watch your stupid YouTube videos that you watch, okay? But if you are, if you think it's not right to do those things at work, then you won't do them. And that's when power is truly effective. Yeah.
And another point he makes here, which I thought was quite funny, and is that he says it's also a way for governments to sort of pretend like they're not expressing power a bit. It's a way for governments to place limits on overt forms of power. They can place limits on what the police are allowed to do. They can place limits on that top-down sovereign power. But at the same time, by developing their departments of education and developing their healthcare systems and this stuff, they're actually expressing more power than they've ever expressed, but in a covert manner.
Yeah,
they're encouraging their citizens to behave in a certain way. It's very sneaky.
Very sneaky.
Yeah, very sneaky.
Now, I think one of the things to bear in mind with this particular work, it's very interesting, hopefully, and it's very, you know, thought-provoking, but it should be thought of as a starting point. Foucault's work has been widely read in a number of disciplines, but it's not just that his work has been widely read, it's been widely taken up and critiqued. Some of the criticisms of this particular text of his is that he's painting with too broad of a brush. He can't distinguish between authoritarian states and liberal ones. He just basically thinks that, like, we're all living in a prison. And this is, for example, an argument that Walzer makes. But the point I really want to draw here is that social theories in general, including the ones put forward by Foucault, they are ways of approaching the world, but they're not endpoints.
No.
They're not endpoints. And well, Louis, what's that sound? Is that the sound for another segment we like to call Wouldn't You Know Smart People Know Stuff? Where we get people who are distinguished in their fields to talk about an issue more broadly.
It's very exciting.
Very exciting.
Very exciting.
So welcome, Dr. Katrina Jaworski.
Thank you for having me.
Katrina is a senior lecturer in the Justice Society Academic Unit at UniSA. Her work spans across a lot of disciplines like continental philosophy, sociology, cultural studies. She's published widely on topics like suicide, death, and dying. And for the purposes of this episode, has drawn a lot from the work of Foucault. And that's what we want to talk to you about today, Katrina.
I'm excited. In a, like, a nerdy good way.
So my first question really is kind of a silly one a little bit. How do you deal with the frustrating aspects of Foucault's work? Because I think a lot of first-year students reading Foucault for the first time, the emotion they might, they might have a range of emotions when they read his work, but one of them usually is frustration. How do you get past that? How do you deal with the frustrations of his work?
I can say this in retrospect, but I didn't know when it was happening to me. So I think one way of dealing it is to read his biography.
I'm
interested in him. Because he was a very kind of really interesting man. He came from a very Catholic family, which, you know, says a lot when you look at all of his works. He also came from a family of doctors, and he read all the time. So, you know, people kind of think Foucault was a party animal doing amazing stuff. I mean, maybe he was, but he was also sitting in the library and reading most of the time. So that's one thing. The other thing is to also not just read his books, but perhaps read the lectures and the interviews. Because it's kind of like a different genre. So one of the ways you can get past that frustration is to say, Foucault's writing is a kind of genre that I have to get used to. And with time, it kind of stays with you. The other thing, of course, is to remember that he's translated from French to English. French functions differently as a language. And I say this because I'm bilingual. And so, you know, I'm always aware in, I mean, I don't know French very well, but I'm always kind of aware of how things get translated from one, you know,
of course,
kind of one language to another. But the last thing, too, is also to remember that in France, they still do philosophy in year 12. Everyone has to. Yeah. So what you get.
That should be the same here.
Yeah. Well, yeah. Well, that would. Scott Morrison would have. Shut up. So the thing to say is that all of the thinkers, they don't have to be in philosophy, are always really philosophical. I mean, if you read Bourdieu and others, they aren't just sociologists, they are actually deeply philosophical. Durkheim was actually, when I read some of his other essays, the guy was actually very poetic and philosophical when he didn't have be up his bonnet about establishing sociology as a discipline. But he just wouldn't admit it. Mm. And by the way, because I was listening to the other podcast, he suffered from eczema, was very itchy all the time. Yeah.
Can I say it's a really interesting insight because when you are in first year or something, you read these texts in quite an abstract way as just a text in itself. Yeah. But what you seem to be saying here is understanding who someone is or who they were really helps to understand their ideas and what they wrote. And this might even be more so with Foucault than anyone else because I feel like there was such significant overlap between how he lived his life and the politics he was engaged with and then what he wrote. Would that be an accurate thing to say about Foucault? Yeah, it would be,
because I think he didn't live one life and write something else.
Mm.
He was true to his call, I would say. So I think with that, I mean, having said that, if you're a first year, you may not have a lot of time to pore over different.
It should be expected.
But at the same time, the point is to maybe that if you get interested in the person behind the text, then that kind hooks you into it. Plus, nowadays, in my day, there was no YouTube. Now, go and have a look. See his, turtleneck ensemble.
Yeah.
By the way, I will say in the podcast, no other man looks as good as he does in a turtleneck.
I feel like there's a lot of Steve Jobs fans right now. raging at the podcast.
You could say they think differently.
Another question for you, Katrina, is one problem that I myself have had with Foucault, and I think a lot of people do, is that he often seems to use terms and concepts in different ways, and sometimes when you're reading him, you think this idea is even contradicting something I've read in his work earlier on. Mm-hmm. But he often described his work as a toolbox where you don't need to piece every single thing together all the time. You can just take an idea and a concept, use it in your own work and apply it.
Yep.
Is there a particular tool from Foucault's toolbox that you found useful in your work?
So before I answer that question, my response is that I think in the archaeology of knowledge, he talks about, if you want to know who I am, don't expect me to stay the same. Because if you did, you'd go ask the state or ask the police to look at my papers and you'll know, in that way. Because I think he was saying that ideas progress and change. And once you, of course, a first sociology student may not really get into that, but once you read his whole body of work, he does change. And he was often frustrated that people, said, well, why have you changed your mind again? And it's like, well, because my thinking is on the go. Now, with regards to the concepts, two things really always have helped me. At the beginning of my work, it was more about discourse and power. And I loved his idea of discourse because he says discourses are about practices that bring subjects and objects into being. On page 42, Archaeology of Knowledge. Thank you very much. I say those details because I used to get into fights at parties because that's what you do when you're a PhD student. And, I would annoy the crap out of the linguists and the semioticians because I felt they perverted Foucault's work because they would say discourse is about language. And on page 49, in the very same text, he says, yes, it is language, but it's so much more than that. It's practices, of course, when you text or some kind of text to analyze a given discourse, but these are the things that we do. And so that links me to the second idea that I get from his toolkit is that his idea of ethics. And I love his work towards the end because it's a very different kind of writing, but also because what he was trying to do is separate morality from ethics, to understand sexuality, to then say, just because you don't approve of it or you like it doesn't mean that it's immoral. It's just ethically different. So I find that really powerful for the way that I'm trying to work with suicide, to say there's a difference between seeing suicide as moral and ethical. And I really want to drive that wedge. And so that's what, at the moment, Foucault's work is actually helping me. And the other part of that notion of ethics is that ethics is about the practices, the things that we do, that kind of form the subjects we want to, or whoever we become. So it's, again, it's not just something as innately bad or good, it's the development of bad or good. Because the beauty with Foucault, you know, I love his stuff where he talks about in Politics of Truth, is one of my favorite little book, and in that, you know, that there's that essay he writes, you know, he's not so much interested in what is true or false. I mean, that's, you know, that's one thing. He wants to know how something becomes true or false, you know. And so, you know, those things really are the things that I continue to come back to, even though I nowadays kind of use different theorists. And what can I say for the podcast listeners? I'm an intellectual tart.
It's interesting, all those aspects that you really like about Foucault, how something becomes seen as true, and the non-language-based aspects of discourse, because that seems to me the key points where power comes into it.
Yeah, absolutely.
Because it's that expression of power that leads to whether something's considered true or not.
Yeah.
And the non-language-based parts of discourse, or, you know, the creation of identities and subjects and these things, once again, an expression of power.
Absolutely. You can say that there's a language with most things, but that is not to say that everything is about language itself. Yeah. And coming back to your point earlier, I think, you know, Foucault's point about discourses in volume of one of History of Sexuality is that they clash and contradict.
Yeah.
So in his analysis, that was evident to a degree, depending on what he was doing at the time, I think.
Well, on the topic of power, thank you very much for providing us with a powerful way of understanding Foucault. Thank you very much for being on the program. And thank you for the listeners for listening. Catch you in the next episode.
Thanks for having me.
Goodbye.
Loon the Sioux is a sociology podcast hosted by Eric Sioux and Louis Everest. It's produced and edited by Eric Sioux, with special assistance from UniSA Online and UniSA Justice and Society. To learn more about studying sociology and other programs online or in person at the University of South Australia, visit unisa.edu.au, where you can search for more details. Loon the Sioux is primarily recorded on the lands of the Kaurna people. The hosts of the podcast would like to pay their respects to elders past, present, and emerging. If you'd like to get in touch or learn more about the podcast, visit our website at sociologypodcast.com. Thanks for listening.